The Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio is on the air.
Okay.
All right. So if you're ready, we can get started whenever.
Well, I'm ready.
Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we're talking Andy Milligan with Hope Stansberry on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, the lovely Hope Stansberry joins us to speak about her career and time working with Andy Milligan. As the writer of his very first short film, Vapors, and a striking presence in several of his later pictures spanning a range from early sexploiters like Depraved and The Degenerates to his legendary horror pictures, The Rats Are Coming, Werewolves Are Here, and Blood, Hope was present and involved with Andy from his pre-cinema days as an off-Broadway playwright in the early 60s, straight through the better part of his East Coast career. Join us as we speak to a stunning gothic beauty from the world of Andy Milligan, the lovely Miss Hope Stansberry, exclusively here on Third Eye Cinema. We have with us tonight a woman who's played an important part in the repertoire of a man who's become something of a legend in New York cinematic circles. While his films were somewhat infamous for their lurid promotional campaigns and the obvious limitations of budget on display, they exude a catty honesty and willingness to lay the obsessions and persona of the director right out in the open, and it's this very quality that keeps him under discussion to this day. As the writer of his very first short film and a striking presence in several of his pictures, as well as being present for his pre-cinema days as an off-Broadway playwright in the early 60s, there are few still among us more qualified to speak of his life and legacy than this woman. Allow me to present a stunning gothic beauty from the world of Andy Milligan, the lovely Miss Hope Stansberry. Hope, welcome to Third Eye Cinema.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
Let's get the hard question out of the way first, because it is a biggie. There's a book out there.
Okay.
There's a book out there that I'm sure you're aware of, which was very well researched and entertainingly written, but which paints a portrait of Andy that's somewhat unflattering. So a major question is, was this in any real sense an accurate portrait of the man as you knew him?
Is that the Gaffney one? I think it was pretty much accurate, yes. And the person who wrote the book, Jimmy McDonough, he actually spent a lot of time with Andy right up until his death.
Wow. So was Andy really that much of a tyrant? Because he's portrayed as being explosive, more than a little abusive.
And well, he could be. He could be, yes. He could be. Uh-huh.
And also, in many respects, he's portrayed as being just as exploitative as the subject matter under discussion and the distributors he worked with. That was why I got to ask this one first before we go anywhere.
It was never that way with me, I have to tell you. But, yeah, he could be. Yeah, he could be explosive.
You know, if this is true, it's kind of hard to picture him building a group of regulars like yourself or Dave Kaler or Jackie Scarvellis, the Borskis. So it's surprising that that's true, that he managed to still gather people that would come back time and time again.
Yeah, but you know something? He never treated – I've never saw him treat his actors that way. And seeing as he did so many things, he did everything practically, you know,
right.
Clothing, makeup on so many of them. And I think that was probably created a lot of stress for him when he was making these movies. He wrote the scripts, you know. He just did everything.
Right.
He was totally a Renaissance man in that way.
Exactly, and I was going to get to that in a bit. Now, Andy's films remain somewhat legendary among cult film aficionados, not only for the Michigan's lurid ad campaigns, which I recall kept the films still in circulation well into the late 70s, but for their psychosexual excesses and their grim artistic leanings. I think a lot of what makes a Milligan film special, for better or worse, isn't so much tied to his limitations of budget and the feel of being a one-man operation, as it is to his often nasty, bitingly sarcastic scripts. And that brings us right back to the beginning and his roots as a playwright. So before we get there, let's start with you. You were actually from this area. You were like a Jersey girl, correct? What motivated the
movie? No, not at all. You know, there's so many, I don't know, it's so funny because there's so many things out there saying I'm from here and I'm from there. Actually, I was raised in Washington, D.C. We were from England. Yeah, my father came over to work for the government, was raised in Washington, and then went to New York City to study acting with Lee Strasberg.
That's what I was going to ask. What brought you
to New York? So that's how I got to New York. Yeah, I always wanted to be an actress, so I wanted to study with Lee Strasberg so badly. So my family let me go to New York, and I had my acting lessons with Lee Strasberg. And actually, my first evening of arrival in New York City was right, my apartment was right behind a theater off Broadway called the Cafe Chino.
Yes.
And Andy Milligan was doing, he had directed a play called One Arm by Tennyson Williams. And I saw the play that night, and I was, like, amazed. I mean, it was so great, so great. And Tennessee Williams, my love, I was so impressed, and with the acting. So that was my first night in New York City.
Okay,
I was impressed. If
you went by the book, it almost led, like, it seemed like he said you were moving to the city because you were busy shoplifting nail polish remover. You know, like I said, the book seemed a little bit tawdry, so you have to wonder what level it reflects reality.
Wait a minute, say that again, polish remover? I missed
that.
Yeah,
yeah. The book had implied that you were shoplifting nail polish remover, and you know, I was thinking maybe that's what moved you to New York City.
You know, Jimmy interviewed so many people, and there's so many stories about me. I don't remember shoplifting. that's not my line.
I wouldn't
have
thought
that. There's other things in that book, in that chapter about me, that I read, and I just couldn't believe. I mean, everybody had a different, I don't know what the word is, but I had a different opinion on me and different, oh, gosh, I can't even think of the word right now, but everybody had something different to say, so a lot of it wasn't true.
That's what I think. In a lot of respects, the book seems kind of tawdry, so that's why I'm trying to, you know, reality check here. What's really the story?
No, and you're right. Some of it is a little tawdry. You're absolutely right. I haven't read it in a long time, but you're right. It does have an element of that to it. And that was probably part of the sensationalism with Jimmy's intent on the book, maybe.
But you weren't unfamiliar with gay culture, even at a fairly young age, because I understand that you used to hang around with hairdressers and drag queens and the like in your teens, when that was more of an unspoken subtext and very much a, quote, secret subculture, societally speaking. And as we were talking about before Stonewall, and we were in, you know, the conformist, quote, unquote, macho McCarthyite 50s. So tell us a little bit about that when, you know, being part
of... Being in an artistic environment, you're surrounded by all types of people.
Right.
And, of course, that was they were incorporated into it. And so by being friends with them and hanging out with them, I wrote, that's what the movie Vapors came from that I wrote. Actually, I wrote it as a play, and Andy read it and said he wanted to do it as a movie. And then it became a cult film.
Right.
And I was, like, totally shocked. I mean, I think I got paid maybe a couple $100 for it. That's the only money I ever saw. But it was a cult film. I mean, I remember seeing the first viewing in a big movie theater in the East Village.
Right.
And it was pretty amazing. I was really surprised at the way people were looking at it and how much people really, really looked at it as being an innovative movie at the time.
Yeah, and it still stands up, but I was going to build up to that, so I'll probably circle around to that in a couple minutes. But what I was going to say is that at the time, it seems like the way culture and society was running in the mainstream, being affiliated with a group of outsiders like that really meant something, and could prove it the least unpopular, maybe even dangerous, depending on who you're dealing with. So I wanted to speak to that. You know, what was it like being part of a group of outsiders at that time that was really a group of outsiders? It wasn't like now where we get the geek chic and all that kind of thing.
Of course. Well, I was an outsider, too, so I never looked at them that way as outsiders. We were all, you know, we were all friends, and we were all part of the same. So I never looked at them as being outsiders, but I always felt that I was an outsider, so I felt very comfortable with them.
So you moved to the East Village, and you had started working at the Cafe Chino. During this time, you apparently adopted a taste for vintage clothes, which was a few years ahead of the curve before the hippies and such started doing the whole granny boots and 1920s fashions thing. So how did that come about?
Well, as interesting you brought that up. Yes, a friend of mine who was a drag queen had a trunk. She was older,
right.
Probably in her 20s, in her youth when she was a drag queen. And I was able to acquire her beautiful clothes from the trunk, and I just fell in love with them, and that's how I started wearing vintage clothing. And no one else was doing it at the time, and that made me an outsider, too. That made me peculiar, you know, to other people, but not to my circle of friends. It didn't.
So tell us a bit about the cappuccino in that crowd, because it went beyond the whole, nowadays, this generic Starbucks model of what yuppies mistakenly think of as a coffee house, but it even went beyond the whole beatnik thing with poetry readings and the like, because Joe Chino actually encouraged people to put on plays here, and he's been credited with creating the whole off-off-Broadway scene that plays the full outside the mainstream. Because, you know, this was certainly taking place.
Yes.
It was taking place early enough to make the argument very plausible, so...
Well, it definitely was the birth of off-off-Broadway, and many, many wonderful plays and famous people today had their plays done there and performed there, and it was a very exciting place to be. I loved being there. I loved the energy, and also there was all innovative performances and plays and playwrights that were exposed there, so it was pretty fantastic. And also, you know, because it didn't have a license, it was being shut down. The police were coming by, and they would shut it down, and then it
Right.
I mean, it was all part of this kind of underworld subculture product of the time. So it was interesting. It was amazing. And that was the first place I ever went to in New York City when I first got there.
Wow. And, you know, it is fascinating to me because even beyond being a typical kind of beatnik coffee house, the guy's putting on plays here. I mean, you actually had people writing plays and performing in basically what I assume was like a coffee house. And that
it was like a coffee house.
Yeah, I mean, it seems very strange, especially to eyes nowadays. But was this going on often, or was it really just Joe's vision?
No, it was Joe's vision. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, I don't know if you know, but he did commit suicide.
Yes.
At a certain point, which is really tragic.
Yes, I didn't even want to bring that one up. So,
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to bring it up.
No, go ahead.
It was just a very tragic thing. And that street, Cornelius Street, had a reputation of suicides.
Wow.
And the ballet dancer jumped out of a five-story window who was part of the Cafe Chino. There was another thing that happened. It was just very, very peculiar surroundings on that street.
Yeah, I mean, I was
very
just trying to be sensitive. It wasn't that I didn't want to touch on it. It was just... But, you know, that's actually kind of strange when you mention that. And I think the book had touched on that, too. Like, what would lead this kind of, I don't know, this atmosphere that would lead people to do that, especially when it wasn't just one or two people. It was like a crowd of people. It was actually just, okay, this is it.
I know. But the Chino was the birth of off-off-Broadway, definitely.
So you had more than a few brushes with so-called fame in the mainstream sense. Tell us about your interactions with Salvador Dali and Carlo Ponti.
Oh my gosh. Oh, Salvador Dali was wonderful. Yes, I used to model for him.
Ah.
He had a suite at the St. Regis Hotel on Fifth Avenue, and I used to meet him there. We'd meet in the coffee shop, or we'd meet in the Old King Cole Bar, which was a great room, and we would meet there. And he had a pet ocelot named, I forgot the cat's name, but he used to sit outside of the cocktail lounge while we would be inside, and there was always a doorman right outside of the cocktail lounge, which was inside of the hotel, and the cat would be sitting outside. Dali, he would always be ordering something in French or Spanish, and I never knew what it was, and when it came to the table, it would be, you know, I always thought it was something exotic, and they would take the silver plate off, and it would be an English muffin or something like that, which always makes me laugh. It just always made me laugh. I found it funny. But he was fascinating. I loved him.
So were you aware of any paintings that he made that we know nowadays that would have been one you modeled for?
You know, I don't. But I know he did a lot of sepia tone drawings. But
yes.
Which an artist always does, usually before they do a painting. But I don't know. I remember one time being in the hotel, and we had just finished or something, and he had just finished a sketch, and he had his secretary, his name was Peter Cook, who was English, and he came out, and they were talking, and Dali had invented these shoes that had springs on them that you could jump up and down with.
Wow.
I don't know if anything ever happened with them, but they were really funny. I loved it.
How about Carlo Ponti? I understand you were involved with him.
Oh, yeah. Well, he was amazing. I had a screen test in William Morris with Carlo Ponti, and I had a very jealous boyfriend at the time.
Right.
very kind of afraid of him. I
right.
was young, and Carlo invited me to come out to dinner with him, wanted to talk, and I was afraid to go, and I turned it down.
Oh.
I was afraid. I know I ruined that whole thing with Carlo Ponte. It was very tragic.
That is too bad. You could have mixed a few Laurent.
Who knows? But, you know, I mean, you can't turn somebody like Carlo Ponte down.
Exactly.
But I did. It's one of those things that I'll always regret.
So were you aware of this whole story that Candy Darling from the Laurel Factory had originally named herself after you as Hope Slattery?
Yes. Yeah, Candy was my roommate for a while. She stayed with me in my apartment. And she was fascinated by me. I never really knew that at the time.
Right.
But she was sweet. She was very sensitive and very pretty. And she ended up, you know, having a little career before she passed away.
Yes.
Which was tragic. Yeah.
But despite all this, you became most famous for your work with Andy Milligan, who in those days, like you mentioned, was still one of those playwrights putting on productions at the Cafe Gino, some of which were his own and some were more famous, like the Tennessee Williams play you mentioned, a few from Jean Genet. But regardless of who he
was
scripting, Andy's productions were
The Jean Genet play was great.
I was just going to say that regardless of who handled scripting, Andy's productions were reputed to really push some boundaries. So, you know, did you notice that while you were there?
Oh, yeah, they were. I mean, The Maids by Jean Genet, I mean, that was an amazing production. The One Arm was also, I mean, both of those productions I thought were pushing boundaries. I really, really liked them both a lot. And that was Andy. He had a definite edge to him that was different, and I think that's what people liked about him.
Yeah.
He was different.
And I was going to ask, and I think you already answered it, but did you find that his work stood out from the rest of the pack, whether for pure shock value or for his snide scripts?
Oh, yeah, definitely stood out, yeah. I mean, the plays that he didn't write them,
right.
But they stood out with his direction.
You know, that's actually what makes a Milligan film for me. You know, you take away all the trappings, the costumes, the settings, the regulars, you know, the overall cheapness of the production, and you still have those wonderfully nasty lines of dialogue he just throw out there like poison pen letters.
I know. He had a way of doing that. You know, I think if Andy could have focused on one element instead of the whole, you know, the whole production,
right.
I think his films could have been great. Quality would have been better.
You know, finally, after all these years, these sort of films are being reassessed, at least by, you know, certain groups of culty people, that, like the people listening to this show, and are being appreciated for their merits as opposed to being put down for, you know, whatever, the Michigan's campaign. So, you know, it's finally coming around, but it took so long. So you're
amazing.
Exactly right.
I had heard, I think it was Jimmy McDonough who wrote The Guest. I once think he told me that Martin Scorsese used to watch Milligan movies. Yeah, I know. I was surprised when I heard that, but that's interesting. So there is a definite cult, Andy Milligan cult following. I get people contacting me a lot.
So was it true that, and I think it was from what you already told me, that there was more of a modicum of police harassment where they'd attempt to raid or bust the establishment for one minor infraction or another? Because those were definitely the times for that.
You mean regarding the Chino?
The Chino, yeah.
Well, you know, I don't know if it was because there was a gay element there or why they did it, or it could have been neighbors complaining. It was probably something like that.
Right.
But there were raids at the time. The gay bars were getting raided, you know, of course, and then Stonewall came along later. But
right.
I think it had a lot to do maybe with possibly the gay element.
That's what I was trying to get at, because
and
it seemed like...
When you have artists, you're going to have a gay element. I mean, it's a natural, you know, part of the arts, I think.
Yeah, and that's what I was trying to get at, because from what I had read, that it sounded like you guys were being targeted just because of that, which, again, that was the times, but...
It was.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Hope Stansberry. Coming up, we discuss Vapors, The Depraved and Degenerates, and The Glory Days of the Deuce, the legendary Times Square grindhouse on the Third Eye Cinema.
happy to appear on Third Eye Cinema. Gene, the host, has been real kind to me and put up with all my BS, so please turn in and listen to the whole little spiel we gave. Hope you guys get something out of it.
Hi, everybody. I am Grand Master of Martial Arts. My name is Y.K. Kim. Person who loves martial arts, live with martial arts, and breathe with martial arts. That is Y.K. Kim. I am a Grand Master of Martial Arts, and at the same time, I'm a producer and director, writer, and actor in the Miami Connection. And I truly enjoyed talking with Gene, Third Eye Cinema. Thank you.
Tell us a bit about Vapors, because you wrote the script, and the film that resulted is just amazing and bizarre in so many respects. As a woman, and you know, I imagine a quote-unquote straight woman, how did you have insight as to what may or may not have been going on down in the bathhouses like the St. Mark's where this was set at?
Basically just hanging around my friends. You know, they would talk about things like going to the bath and use certain expressions of the time and like a trick, you know, or, you know, certain things like that. And I just picked all of that up from them, and I just got this idea to write it. And, you know, I was very young when I wrote it, and I wrote it at night.
Yeah.
I never wrote during the day. I wrote it at night. I wrote another one, too, called The Trip, which was nothing ever happened with. They were thinking of doing it at the Actors Studio, but nothing ever came of it.
So, Andy, just how do you get involved with this? How do you pick this up from you? Because you said you wrote it as a play originally.
I wrote it as a play, yeah. Well, you know, Andy and I and his partner, Jerry, we were very good friends, Jerry and I. We used to go to auditions together, and Andy wanted to read it, and he read it, and he said he wanted to make a movie out of it. And, you know, that's what happened. Although I was a little shocked at the ending.
Yeah, I was going to ask, you know, have you seen the final result, and did he essentially deliver it what you had envisioned, or did he take it somewhere completely different?
You know, he did pretty much what I envisioned, except for a few things, but again, I was a little shocked at the ending. he added a little, you know, something I wasn't expecting. So I thought, oh, I was a little taken back by that. But other than that, it pretty much was the script.
And I understand that the film actually did quite well on the gay film circuit, whatever that classification entails. You know, I gather wherever they ran things like Kenneth Anger films or Derek Jarman films, they might have also run Vapors. Now, I don't imagine either of you saw any real residuals on this, but artistically speaking, are you happy with its legacy?
You know, I don't know. I really don't know that much about its legacy, but I have to tell you, I did get an email from a film professor and a director. Keith Bearden is his name. I think that's his last name. He commented me on the film and how innovative it was. And that's the first time I've ever really had any feedback from it in years. And I thought, wow, you know, I was very impressed with what he wrote. And so it really kind of was a shock to me. I wasn't expecting anything like that. I couldn't believe it.
One thing that's quite surprising is that with so many of Andy's films, particularly the early sexploiters, now being lost, Vapors not only survives, but it's out there on DVD with The Body Beneath. So have you seen that?
It is?
Yeah.
The quality must be terrible. I can't imagine.
Well, I don't know.
You know, there's a famous casting director in L.A. in that movie.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah. His name is on there. It's Joel Thurm. But yeah. He had a small part. I think he was like the attendant or something at the bathhouse. But he's a big, huge casting director in L.A.
Nice. So tell us about how you made the move from waitressing at the Cafe Chino and doing the script for Andy to actually starring in his films.
Well, you know, the reason I did his films was just, I have to be honest with you, I wasn't impressed by them, let's put it that way. For me, it was all about the work and hoping it would lead to something else. And I was really, at that point, you know, I think at that point I wasn't with William Morris. I think it came after when I started doing Off-Broadway.
Right.
I did a play called Chocolates with Gabriel Dell, and then William Morris picked me up and signed me. And then they wanted me to go to Hollywood to sign one of those Hollywood contracts that they still had at the time, and I turned it down. Another thing I did, which was foolish, but I turned that down, and I probably could have had a career if I hadn't turned it down, but it was all about the work to me and the theater at the time. So that's what I was into it.
Well, you know, there's something to be said for being independent. It's just whether you're happy with what you did or not. So it becomes clear in retrospect.
It does. And, you know, who knows what my life would have been if I had done that. I don't know. There's a reason for everything, I guess.
Right.
So supposedly,
That's kind of what I tell my wife. You know, I made a lot of mistakes in my life, but you know, if you go down another road, I might not have met you. You know, things happen for a reason.
True.
So
that's true.
So I believe your first two films with Andy were Depraved and The Degenerates, both of which are unfortunately among his lost efforts. So we don't have a lot of information to work with. You know, we have a still here and there, maybe a lobby card, but that's really it. So tell us about these two films, because I understand The Degenerates was filmed in a mansion that was reputed to be haunted.
Wait a minute, The Degenerates. I'm trying to remember. I don't remember what that. Okay, there is two. I can't separate those two for some reason. The one I played a very sophisticated lesbian in. And actually, you know, I wish I could see that movie again. I don't remember much about it, to tell you the truth.
Yeah, my understanding about The Degenerates, anyway, was that it was somewhat akin to what Radley Metzger did later with Score, you know, sort of a bisexual partner swapping thing. And I think The Depraved was the one you were mentioning where you were like the lesbian casting director. Both of these films, the only other thing I know about them is that they starred Ann Linden from The Ghastly Ones.
I just really can't remember much about those two. I remember the one, oh gosh, I wore this kind of, it was about Seven Sisters or something. I wore a little burlap dress. I don't know which one. That was probably The Degenerates, maybe.
Right.
Again, The Depraved and The Degenerates. I have some pictures from those, though. We shot that somewhere upstate New York, I think, or in the country. And he actually had a team of people there. He wasn't doing everything himself. He had somebody cooking. He had somebody doing makeup. And he actually had some help on that film. And I remember there was a rape scene where I got raped. That's all I can remember. I don't remember too much.
Well, of all things to remember.
Yeah, I know. I can't remember too much about that movie.
You were actually involved in another more mainstream film around the time, For the Love of Ivy. And this was actually a film that Sidney Poitier wrote as well as starred in, a fairly early film revolving around a black couple, but which can't really be classified as blaxploitation. And I know he brought along one of his favorite co-stars from the era, Carol O'Connor and Beau Bridges. Do you have any memories of this picture?
I do. I worked with a young guy who was Marilyn Monroe's son. Did she have a son? He was related to Marilyn Monroe, which was interesting. My memory's faltering, but it was a cast of people. Sidney Poitier was gracious. He was wonderful. I do remember that. And there were some fun scenes that were shot at the village gate. And, you know, they were supposed to be beatniks and village types at the time, but it was fun to work on. Daniel Mann, I think, was the director.
And you're listed as, I believe it's like off Broadway couple, so I'm not sure how large your role was.
Oh, yeah, there was a play within the movie. It was supposed to be, the actors were all living on stage. That's what
right.
It was.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And I played the daughter in the family. Yeah.
And I think this movie actually went up for some awards. Did this impact you in any way? Did it help your career out at all? Or was it just something to say, hey, look, I did this?
Yeah, I got a commercial out of it. I got an IBM commercial out of it. That was about it.
So it was mentioned in passing in the McDonough book that you and Andy had regular run-ins or battles of will. What was that all about? Does it go back to what I understand to be his inherent irascibility?
Oh, no. Actually, it would have been me probably wanting to do something differently from his direction and wanting it to be done my way.
Right.
Probably what it was. Yeah. Not agreeing with his way of doing it, wanting it done my way.
Two strong wills together, I understand.
Yes.
So what was it really like working with Andy Milligan? Because, you know, he had this reputation that by most accounts involved a real hatred of women, and he would apparently reputedly badger actresses to the point of tears, and even males complained about how nasty he could get. But you didn't really experience any of that. Did you get to see a different side of him?
Never with me. He adored me. Never with me. I was really, you know, good friends with Andy. And, again, his partner Jerry and I were really, really close friends, so therefore I was friends with Andy. But Andy never treated me that way. He treated me with great respect, and I felt nothing but kindness from him.
So do you think it was true that all of his films, all of his scripts and all of his plays can essentially be boiled down to his continually working out his relationship to his family, and in particular to his mother, who the book presents as being fairly repulsive and distasteful, to say the least?
I have to read it again. I don't know anything about Andy and his family, and we never talked about that. I never heard him talking about that. The strangest thing to me was when he got married to Betsy. That was the most acute. Nobody could believe that. And it was the gossip of the West Village. So I that was, to me, the oddest thing. Other than that, that to me was when Andy...
Did he ever give you a rationale for that? Because it was such a strange move.
No, I never got any. I never asked him. So,
wow.
Maybe it was for tax reasons. Who knows? I don't know.
Were you at all privy to the whole relationship between Andy and the Mishkins? Because much has been made of it over the years, and the urban legend is that Lou Mishkin actually melted down the prints he had of Andy's films for the silver content, which, if it's true, really says a lot.
I don't know, but I know there was a lot of arguments with the Mishkins. I know there was a lot of controversy, but I don't know exactly what.
But regardless of how true, you know, the whole thing may or may not have been, it's been often remarked upon that it was quite a stormy business relationship, which is funny given that however poorly financed his films might have been, these were the guys funding his movie career. So, you know, it's just strange in that respect.
I know. I remember different aspects of it, but I don't remember anything in particular. I never got involved in that.
So between what we understand to be his relationship to his mother and family and the more well-documented relationship to the Mishkins, you can draw some fairly solid parallels to the sort of dark, sadomasochistic, ambisexual, and perhaps even incestuous goings-on he drew out in his films, particularly when you have something like Seeds or The Body Beneath, but really through his entire filmography. Was any of this, you know, did you pick up on any of this when you're working with him?
No, but there was that element in his work and in his plays that he directed. And that was, you know, that was, again, I don't know what he did sexually in bed. I have no idea. But there was that element there. Yeah, there definitely was the element there. But as far as that goes, I don't know anything else beyond that.
Right, because, I mean, what I was thinking is, you know, how much did this sort of thing where he was effectively trapped by his own past, so to speak, in a cycle of abusive relationships that he seemed to continually seek out and create, as well as being caught in and limited by, maybe determine the direction his life and career wound up taking?
Uh-huh, I know. Well, you know, I don't know how he carried his psyche out from the movies into his real life. I never saw that part of him. I couldn't imagine my friend Jerry, his partner, and Andy having any kind of relationship like that. But then, again, those things are personal and private, so we don't talk about them.
So can you speak a bit to the whole Grindhouse experience, what it was like in the world of Times Square and, quote, the deuce of 42nd Street in those days? Because this is where Andy and Mishkin held court. This was the main place where his films were shown, and they rotated from theater to theater. And it was even where Andy lived and ran a theater company as we get later into the 70s and 80s. And I'm sure you must have gone with him to see some of your films.
It was sleazy then. There was a lot of peep shows and prostitutes and pimps walking down the street. I haven't been back to New York since I moved here to Santa Fe, and I understand it's like Disney World now.
Yes.
But then it was a whole different world. I remember he did have a studio there. I remember being in the studio, and it was huge. It was huge. It had the whole one floor level, and it was just a complete mess. That's all I remember. But
wow.
Yeah, it was that was a strange. And then Andy, I had a theater, you know,
right.
At one point too. I never got involved with that. His plays that he wrote, I wasn't interested in doing or being involved in part of that. I didn't care for his writing.
Really?
As far as the theater went, no.
Mm-mm. Okay. So was it as crazy, you know, being in that whole area of Times Square as patrons always reported? Because there's a hilarious book out there called Sleazoid Express that goes in depth about the ambiance, the crowd, and the genres of film each theater on the Strip specialized in at the time. And I'm actually friends with a few people who are of age and inclination have been to some of those places back in the days when you were effectively taking your life in your hands going there. You know, bums, runaways sleeping there when they ran all-night marathons, junkies, hookers, bathroom and in-seat sexual encounters. Did you see any of this sort of thing going on?
Oh, yeah, it was like that. Oh, absolutely. And also, I remember there was a Pab Steakhouse, which was right on 42nd Street. And I remember a Salvador Dali film was playing with my film, Vapors.
Wow.
No, I never went up to 42nd Street that often.
Right.
But there were sometimes you had to go up there in that area for certain things. But, yeah, I do remember walking by and seeing that. And if I had had, you know, a camera or an iPhone like it is today, I would have taken a picture.
Yeah, because I was just wondering if Annie took you to see any of the films when they were screening, so in which case you would have been in these theaters.
That's true. I did go see several of the films there.
So did you see any of this stuff firsthand?
Did I? Oh, yeah. You mean the people on the streets?
Yeah, just all the people in the theater, all this craziness going on.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, my God. There was a man in a raincoat. I would never go by myself, believe me,
right.
The 42nd Street Theater, but I think I was with Jerry at the time, Jeremy, and this man kind of slipped next to us with a raincoat on, and don't know what he was doing underneath it, but we moved quickly. Yeah. That's 42nd Street.
Showcase in the Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Hope Stansberry. In our final segment, we discuss Rats Are Coming to Worlds Are Here in Blood, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
My name is Niko Mastorakis, and if it's all Greek to you, Google me. I have written, produced, and directed several movies, not all of them good movies, some of them very good movies, but more interesting than the movies themselves is a lengthy interview at Third Eye Cinema. If you miss it, you don't like movies.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square.
Now, there was a bit of a break where I guess Andy had made the transition from sexploitation to his version of a horror film. And these were doubly strange in a way because there was really nothing scary about them unless you were really attached to the idea of family and straight society as sort of an inviolable be-all, end-all. And he had developed this propensity for setting them in a Victorian time period, and they tended to kind of stiff and stodgy in style. They feature a lot of old-fashioned costumery, the sort that was considered, well, a date even in the earliest days of cinema, never mind the early 70s. So what did you think of being in these sort of films with him?
The Victorian style ones, The Rats Are Coming, for instance.
Right, the horror films.
And
yeah.
Blood, and right. Blood, those two. I thought they were actually his better films. I thought the quality was a bit better than the other ones. Well, you know, he had more experience by then, too. We did The Rats Are Coming in London,
right.
In England, and a large mansion. And then the other one, Blood, was shot in Staten Island.
Yeah, I'm going to circle around to him in a minute, because I was thinking that maybe this whole business with the costumes and the finery might have come from his background as a fashionista, because some listeners might not be aware that those credits, Fashion by Raffiné, actually referred to Andy himself, because he had gone by them.
Yes.
He was trying to make a living as a designer. And sensational story, but I'm led to understand that his personality actually caused the adventure to fail, because he would actually attack customers who he thought were, you know, fat or didn't look good in his designs, not only in the sense of verbal abuse, but actually ripping up his outfits or even tearing them off people, trying them on. Do you know if there's any truth to this?
Oh, I think I've heard that he used to have a shop in the Village on West 4th Street,
right.
And I didn't know him at that time when he had the shop, but there were stories about that, so I'm sure they're probably true.
Wow. You know, usually when you ask these questions to people, it's like, oh, no, that's not really true. Here's the real story. It's like, no, it's probably true.
Oh, no, I think those are probably true, definitely.
Wow. Andy actually asked that you come over to England to film what at the time was known as House of the Full Moon, and then I understand that Michigan had later demanded it be retooled, adding extra footage into what we know as The Rats Are Coming, The Werewolves Are Here. So tell us a bit about that production and the whole situation over in England.
Oh, it was great, actually. The actors were wonderful. There was a couple of very talented actors in it. There was an old character actor in it. I can't remember his name, but he was really good. And the environment was great. It was fun. He had a team of people working for him,
right.
And the scene with the rats was shot later in
right.
Staten Island. There's a scene with me talking to the rats.
Yes.
And there's actually a glass partition between us because I can't stand rodents. So
I was wondering about that.
That was a really funny scene. I did not enjoy doing that because I don't like rodents.
What I had heard about the whole England venture was that Andy had made an effort to get away from the Michigans, taking an offer to do a few pictures over there for Leslie Elliott. But once again, he apparently had a falling out with the producer-distributor, which in this case was Leslie's father. And by the time we got to House of the Full Moon, he was back under the Michigans despite still filming over in England. So was it a lot different working over there, or was it just more the same but in a different country?
No, you know, it was better. It was different. It felt more professional.
Yeah, I mean, because those films, you can tell right away that the atmosphere is different, the settings, there's something about it that, you know, really kind of elevates it. So what were your impressions of some of the other folks who worked with you who had also become regulars? I'm thinking of Dave Kaler and Jackie Scarvellis.
Jackie was, she was great. She was great. They were all wonderful. They were all really wonderful, warm, friendly people to work with.
So you weren't acquainted with Andy's other regulars, Hal Borsky and Neil Flanagan, were you? Because you never starred alongside either of them.
No, I knew both of them well. Hal was great. In fact, I saw Hal not too long ago, well, a couple of years ago up in Taos. He was in some sort of a care apartment situation. He was disabled, I think, from a stroke, but I went up there to see him. And it was kind of an interesting environment because there was a drag queen
right.
that lived next door to him, and then there was this beautiful elderly woman in a wheelchair. She was just so sweet. She had a history. And so it was all these interesting characters that were living together, not in the same room, but in the same little complex there. It must have been some kind of shared, it was like these little apartments, and they were probably for people, I think it must have been for people that had disabilities of some sort.
But getting
yeah.
back to the film, your part became more closely tied to the whole Rats Are Coming angle that Mishkin requested to exploit the popularity of Willard, which was doing some real box office at the time. So were you aware of changes from the original film, and were you involved at all in that version or solely in the revised material? Because you do have scenes with Jackie, and she was definitely part of the original werewolf story.
Oh, no. The whole thing with the rats, that came after. That was
okay.
added on after the film was made. Yeah.
So
that's
did you
when,
actually...
That's when, yeah, that's when the Michigans wanted that added in. So that's how that came about.
Yeah, because it wasn't like you were completely separate from them. You actually had scenes with these people that were in the original film, House of Full Moon.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh.
The film
Absolutely.
Is distinguished by having Andy himself make an appearance as the shopkeeper who sells you a gun. Why do you think he took this role, since I believe this is the only time he's ever been captured on camera?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I don't remember that too well. Maybe he didn't have anybody else to do it at the time. I don't remember.
And kind of like what you were saying, this is actually among my favorite Milligan pictures, at least given the few that are actually available on DVD in one form or another. And I also believe it's the only picture you were involved with as an actress that's actually out DVD at the moment. So it shows what an impression you made.
You know, that's interesting because I get a lot of people contacting me saying they love my work in that movie.
Because, I mean, if you go back and look, it's like, well, okay, nothing is really out except Vapors, which you wrote, and then Rats Are Coming, Werewolves Are Here. Okay, Blood was out on VHS, but it's not out on DVD. So basically, your impression is just like, there's this girl in this movie. Wow. You know? So it says a lot.
That's how I met Jimmy McDonough, I guess, was through that movie.
Yeah.
And that I met him because he was, interviewing people with Andy. In fact, he did a lot of interviewing.
Yeah.
He did a lot. I spent a lot of time with him.
Yeah, it's apparent from the book. There's a lot of material there that you couldn't just get basically making it up. But, you know, again,
mm-hmm.
there's such an element to it that I wanted to ask people that were there, like, is this really true or is it just played up for sensationalism?
No, I think it's true. I mean, I have to reread the book again. It's been a while since I read it, but it's pretty accurate, I'd say.
So particularly in this film, being paired off in contrast with Jackie Scarvellis, who's very olive-toned and dark, the whole gothic paleness you carry around is quite striking. You know, in the hands of the right filmmaker, you could easily have been another Barbara Steele. You happen to have a very similar vibe.
Thank you.
A year later, you were involved with Blood, which was one of the final pictures Andy had made before he moved to Los Angeles. And like I said, once again, it's unavailable on DVD, but it was on VHS, so I've got my fingers crossed. So tell us a bit about that production. I mean, this time you were the daughter of Dracula, married to a werewolf, and I believe you're being fed blood by a vampiric plant.
Yes. Oh, gosh. Well, there's one thing I do remember, and I wouldn't do it. He wanted me to chop the mouse in half. Yeah, and I refused to do it, and I was really upset that was in the movie. They had somebody else's, some guy do it, and they used to put the dress on that I was wearing in the movie and had him do it. But I was very upset. I really didn't want him to do it. I begged him not to do it, and he did. That was part of the sensationalism that he had, add into it.
Wasn't there something similar in The Rats Are Coming where, again, I assume that couldn't have been you, where I forget where the rats got kicked or I don't know what, set on fire. I don't remember the specific scene.
Oh, I don't remember that. No, I threw not a real rat. I threw a rat across the room. It bit me, but that was not a real one.
Okay.
I wouldn't hold a real one.
And again, Blood seems to be another entertaining film along the lines of Rats Are Coming. I understand, though, that Andy actually looked down on horror films, and yet that's what he's best known for and probably his most enduring legacy. So, again, there's a dichotomy.
It is interesting. It is, I know. And maybe he did them because it was a way to, make films at the time, because those were the ones that he could get produced.
So one thing of interest is that one of your co-stars in this film was a Patricia Gall, who went on to have something of a television career afterwards. And among Milligan veterans, only a few of them, namely Carol Vogel from Depraved and some of the Britons like Burla Kaler, Noel Collins, and Joan Ogden, actually continued on the limelight post-Andy. And it appears that those who did seem to gravitate towards television parts over film roles. So I was wondering, was working with Andy that traumatic? You know, why did everybody either just drop out totally or go into TV?
Probably that's where it was, you know, the money was, I'm sure.
On the other side of the equation, do you think that, and I think, again, you might agree with this from what you said earlier, do you think that all the difficulties with financing and distribution and the strain of having to be director, cinematographer, scripter, costumer, and having to work with an aging camera and throwaway short ends was starting to wear on Andy? Because he first went out to Staten Island and then later back to 42nd Street to establish a theatrical troupe of his own to put on his old plays and a few new ones for the off-off Broadway crowd. And it seems like he was starting to go full circle back to the days of the Cappuccino.
You're right, you're right. Maybe that's where his heart really was in the theater, and he was just doing the movies to, you know, maybe get some success and make some money so he could really do what he really wanted to do. Maybe that was the theater, I don't really know, but I don't think the theater was a success.
Yeah, unfortunately. Eventually, he moved out west. Now, I remember reading one of his last interviews when he was still in New York, and he was going on about how dangerous it was getting to be there, you know, and how the whole temper of the times had changed. It's gotten darker and more violent. He sounded very resigned. I forget where I read it. Might have been in the Times. It was years ago.
That Andy?
Yeah.
Moved because of that? I didn't know that. No, I didn't. I never really knew why he went to L.A., what his reason was. That I don't know. I know Jimmy followed him out there and spent time with him there, too. I never really knew why he made that move to L.A.
So Andy eventually headed out to Los Angeles, obviously, where he got involved with a new crowd, an old boyfriend, and even a few final films, the last, at least one of which was once again financed by the Michigans. But this was a long time distant from the days you were involved with him and his crowd. So what made you decide to move west yourself, away from the East Village and that whole scene?
Well, for me, I was tired of auditioning. I was tired of New York. And I just wanted a whole different environment. I wanted to move away from the city. So I came to Santa Fe on a trip, and I said, I'm going to move here. And I moved here in 3 months. You know, I mean, I was really looking to get out of the urban lifestyle like that, like, you know,
right.
Noise, the stress.
Yeah, because, I mean, based on that interview that I had read years ago with Andy, I was wondering if it was the same thing where it's just like seeing all the changes that were happening in the 80s, because things really did turn sour, particularly under Dinkins. It started feeling very unsafe and turbulent during that time. And I was wondering if that's what drove both of you out.
You know, that's true. Well, that was part of it, too. Yeah. I think when crack came in, crack was so popular, that's when the element became raunchy, really raunchy and violent and scary. It wasn't like it used to be. And the Village used to be such an amazing place, full of artists and just everything about it. Now it's you know, it's all yuppified and it's completely different.
Thank you.
So that's another reason. I you know, I have memories of it the way it was, and that's the way I like to remember it. But it was time for a change. Time for change.
Yeah.
Maybe that's what it was for Andy. Maybe it was time for a change. But here Jeremy, his partner, is still living there in Soho in the same apartment.
So when you look back, do you miss the days with Andy and the Cappuccino crowd, sort of like, you know, what a crazy time we had, kind of nostalgia? Or is it more filed away with the scrapbooks in the sense of that was a different time and a different person?
You're right, I do. It was a different time and it was a different person, even though it was me, but it was different.
So in sum, what do you think the legacy of Andy Milligan is? Do you think that he has been or can be any sort of inspiration to viewers and budding filmmakers and playwrights out there?
I don't think playwrights, because I don't really consider him a writer. As far as inspiration, I think maybe to some young filmmakers, possibly, if they knew the history behind him and how he did these independent films, I think in that sense. As far as quality, you know, I don't think it would, that reflects into the filmmakers of today. But I think his inspiration as far as, you know, that what he did and that he made these films and what he made these films on, practically nothing, shot scenes out of his apartment, out of his house. In that respect, I think so. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah, that was my take on it. It's like, you know, everybody's busy looking at the fact that this isn't a Hollywood production, but, you know, I'm seeing, oh, my God, this guy did it all himself, and that impresses me.
I know.
So,
amazing.
So,
makeup, hair, clothes, I mean, amazing.
So did you have any sort of, you know, website or contact information that you wanted to share with listeners, or would you rather maintain, like, a modicum of privacy?
Oh, well, actually, you know, I would have become a botanical alchemist, and I have a company. It's called Royal Gardens Aromatics.
Okay.
It's a website. I make, and well, I sell, of course, but I make organic, all-natural skincare, body and bath products from herbs and essential oils. They're quite wonderful, and I'd love to share that with everyone. Royal
sure.
Gardens Aromatics.
It's, you know, I've got to say, just breaking in, it's fascinating to hear that you don't sound like you've aged a day. I mean, it's the same woman speaking to me that was speaking on, you know, The Rats Are Coming. It's bizarre. So congratulations on that.
And, you know, even though I went through all of that and I lived in those times and everything, I'm still really the same person except just different.
Yeah.
Mature, maybe. Just grown in different ways.
Fascinating.
We all do.
So is there anything else you want to mention before we close?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you. It's the first time I've ever really done anything like this, talked about Andy's movies, and so I'm glad I did it. I've always been afraid to do this kind of thing or just think that's all part of the past. I'm not interested in that anymore. But, you know, it was quite interesting, and I really enjoyed it, and thank you so much.
Well, with that hope, I'd really like to thank you for joining us here on Third Eye Cinema and for sharing your memories of Andy.
And thank you, Gene. I appreciate it.
All right. It was really great talking to you. I really appreciate this.
Great talking to you, too. Have a wonderful day.
You, too.
Bye-bye.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, one of the homes for highbrow interview entertainment.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Hope Stansberry. In 2 weeks, on week 41 of Third Eye Cinema, vocalist Kara McCutcheon and guitarist Alex Gutierrez join us from Bay Area-style Canadian retro thrashers Morphillery. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or your filmmaker and musician would like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com, visit our website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com, or our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema brought to you by the Big Papa Online Network, Blog Talk Radio. Or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience.
We deliver tickets, t-shirts, and everything you need to rock. But what you really get is so much more.
FedEx, delivery.
Passion, what we deliver by delivering.